degrees in southwestern Missouri. Lows overnight will range from the low teens across northern Wisconsin to the mid-30s in the Boot Heel of Missouri. The National Weather Service forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy with a high of 32 and a wind out of the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of patchy freezing drizzle. The low 28. The wind will be out of the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 35, the wind from the northwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with scattered snow flurries, the low 25. Sunday, partly sunny with a high of 32. Sunday night and Monday, mostly cloudy with a low Sunday night in the low 20s and a high Monday in the upper 20s. Tuesday, cloudy with a chance of snow and a high in the mid-20s. At noon Central Time, northern Illinois and northern Indiana were seeing partly sunny skies. Most central and southern locations were cloudy. The temperatures ranged from the low 20s to 40 degrees. At Rockford, 21. Chicago, 28 at O'Hare Airport. Bloomington Normal reported 27 degrees. It was 25 at Mattoon, 40 degrees at Carbondale. In South Bend and Lafayette, 29 degrees at the top of the hour. Indianapolis reported 26. Terre Haute checked in with 25 degrees. And at Evansville, it was 31. Willard Airport reported cloudy skies at the top of the hour, 27. Degrees. The dew point 22, the relative humidity 81%, the wind out of the southwest at 7, giving us a wind chill of 19, and the barometric pressure 29.97 and steady. And at 12:39 Central Time, 27 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Three years ago, Massachusetts wooed Evergreen Solar to locate in a former Army base that had been converted to an office park, hoping that it would boost the state's reputation as a hub for green industry. The company makes solar panels. But today, the plant's 800 employees are looking for new jobs. Evergreen Solar is moving its operation to China. NPR's Tovia Smith has more.
On paper, this was a match made in heaven. Young, attractive, green energy company willing to relocate seeks generous admirer for mutually beneficial relationship. And environmentally minded empty nester seeks trophy tenant to lavish in love. Before you could say love at first sight, Evergreen moved in, began to reap millions in fringe benefits, and the family grew from 1 to 3 to 800 employees. Until one day, the state woke up to what was basically a note on the kitchen table saying Evergreen was leaving.
I was shocked.
Jack Burrows got the news 1 week after starting work at Evergreen. While many are furious at Massachusetts for giving the company so much, Burrows says maybe Evergreen didn't get enough.
I like the idea of the state supporting an industry such as this, but maybe there needs to be more federal support.
Massachusetts Economic Development Secretary Greg Bialecki agrees.
We feel like we gave it our best shot, and I think realistically we have to talk about what role the federal government is going to play to keep manufacturing here and not to let it go overseas.
Indeed, Evergreen says don't blame us for walking out.
Yes, it's gone bad, but there are two sides to the story.
CEO Michael L. Hillo says Evergreen can't compete with companies in China that get way more government support. He says Washington needs to nurture fledgling industries.
It's also the role of government to make jobs for our citizens, our children. That's their role. Or let's acknowledge that we're going to lose in the job creation stream.
Yeah, you know, it sort of has remarkable chutzpah, doesn't it?
That's Harvard economics professor Ed Glaser, who says government should not be playing venture capitalist and definitely shouldn't have invested in manufacturing in such a high-cost labor market. Republican State Representative Brad Jones says the state was seduced by a sexy new industry.
There was a leading with your heart, not your head, which was, I really believe in this, and this is going to be great. This is going to put us on the map, and we're going to be, you know, green, green, green. This is great. And I think that served to cloud judgment.
Even Democratic supporters like State Senator James Eldridge are now expressing mourning after regret.
I admit that I was mistaken. I learned my lesson.
The most important, get a better prenup. State officials concede their deal could have been tougher, but ultimately they say they will recover most their investment if you count taxes that have come in and future benefits that will never be paid out. And they point to the hundreds who had jobs through three tough years. But Harvard's Ed Glaser says the biggest mistake would be to measure an energy policy by how it works as a jobs program.
We need a good energy policy. But the point of that policy should not be to maximize the number of employees. You know, if we try to do energy and jobs together, I think we get neither a good energy program nor a good jobs program.
So Massachusetts may have lost 800 jobs, but Glaser says if the state's investment helps reduce long-term costs of green energy, well then, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
A spate of attacks in Iraq last week showed that the Sunni insurgency remains a force to be reckoned with. The movement started with Saddam loyalists and militants from neighboring countries whose aim was to fight Americans. Then they turned on their Shiite countrymen. Now they seek to destabilize what they see as a U.S.-backed, Shiite-led government. The story we're about to hear is part of the NPR series, The Hidden World of Girls, Girls and the Women They Become, produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. This installment is reported by Kelly McEvers.
At first, Umm Salah is leery. 21 years old and stubborn. She comes from a traditional village in Diyala province, a former al-Qaeda stronghold about an hour north of Baghdad. She won't give us her full name. When we ask about her husband, she only says this.
He was a good guy, and actually no one would criticize him for anything. He was a good man.
But we know different. We know Umm Salah's husband was a high-ranking member of the Islamic State of Iraq, the local branch of al-Qaeda. We also know he was accused of helping kill Umm Salah's father, and that he was handed over to authorities by her own brother. Eventually, Umm Salah admits that her husband was part of what she calls the resistance. She shows us a record of her marriage. It was performed by a religious cleric.
Oh, it's on a piece of notebook paper.
Does it have a date? Did he sign it?
Not signed. No date. Nothing.
What this means is Umm Salah is not legally married, and that her 2.5-year-old boy, Salah, is not registered with the government. No registration means no food ration card, no right to visit the hospital, no school. Umm Salah says that with her husband now in jail and accused of being a terrorist, she has no money and no hope. While she talks, Salah hangs on her shoulder.
Sometimes, you know, when she is so much fed up with her situation, she would just pray for God. God, take my life. Let me die with my son now.
Aid groups say there are more than 100 women like Umm Salah in Diyala province alone. With that in mind, the Iraqi government recently launched an anti-al-Qaeda media campaign. A video showed authorities digging through a bomb-making factory, and it urged women not to marry insurgents. Marry a terrorist and your children will have no rights, the campaign goes. Marry a terrorist and you'll be shunned by society. The program, broadcast on state TV, featured two women who said they were forced to marry foreign fighters. This woman says her uncle arranged a marriage with a Palestinian-born militant from Syria. The man was later killed in a raid by Iraqi troops. About 20 women who once were married to militants have recently been detained. Ministry of Defense spokesman Mohammed al-Askari says he finds it hard to believe that any of them are totally innocent.
It's my personal opinion, of course, this is my personal opinion only, is that if you live with someone for sure, even if you don't know what he's doing, but you know his reactions, his mentality, his ideology, the way he reacts, so you should be knowing something about him, even as a woman living with him in one place.
Mohammed agrees. She's also from Diyala province, and she was also married to an insurgent. She says the people in her village willingly joined the insurgency because fighters promised to rid Iraq of the American invaders.
Those guys, you know, had a very sweet talk. They were all pious people who prayed and fasted.
Muhammad says the women naturally helped these men, who they saw as holy.
They would hide men when the men wanted to move. They would disguise them in women's clothes and help them. And, you know, if someone would come and ask about, where is he? He said, oh, we don't know, while he's hiding in her house.
What the government is not doing is providing any kind of social services to the women like Mohammed who've been left behind, whether they're guilty of collaborating with the insurgency or not. In a country with millions of orphans and widows, officials say it's tough to make a priority out of women who are seen as criminals, which means they're basically ignored by everyone, says Hannah Edouard, who heads a local women's rights group.
They are not recognized, you know, in respecting their dignity. I mean that they miss housing, they miss health protections, they miss education.
Edouard says the only way out for most of these women is to marry again. Rawah Ismail is from Anbar province, another former al-Qaeda stronghold. One day, insurgents showed up at her house and forced her to marry one of them.
We didn't have like a bedroom, a real bedroom. They just put me in the room, and I was raped in the real sense of the word.
After that, Rawah and her mother fled. They were considering going to a women's shelter, but they were afraid the militants would come after them. Since then, they've been moving from house to house, relative to relative. Even their own people are ashamed of them. Now, Rawah is staying with her sister, who is married. At least now, she says, there's a man in the house to take care of her. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Baghdad.
Isra Al-Rubia contributed to that report.
Every month, 170 million Americans use public media. That's like everyone who lives west of the Mississippi.
Plus everyone in New York and Florida. More than half the country uses public media to be informed, engaged, and inspired. Now, public media needs your support.
Learn more about federal funding for public media at 170.